We've all heard of the tough-on-crime policies of the 80s and how they disproportionately affected African Americans in cities across the nation. Today, in the middle of the opioid crisis, we think of addiction less as a crime and more as a disease that needs to be treated. But two reporters from the Asbury Park Press found that some things haven't changed.
Today, as pervasive as opioids is, 20,000 more blacks are arrested for cocaine than whites are for opioids. That really gave us pause.
Why did policies about drug addiction change? And how are the vestiges of those policies from 30 years ago still present today? I'm Annette John Hall. This is The Why.
My name is Shannon Mullen. I'm a staff writer at the Asbury Park Press.
My name is Austin Bogues. I'm a staff writer at the Asbury Park Press.
30 years ago in the 1980s, in the early 90s, the crack epidemic was at its peak, and certainly it was treated differently than the opioid crisis is now. And one of the people who was caught up in the crack epidemic was a woman named Michelle Goodwin. Take me through her story.
Michelle is 53 today. She lives in Asbury Park on the Jersey Shore. And Michelle got into crack almost as soon as crack hit her city. And she really fell deeply into addiction.
I was homeless for like 10 years out on the street. And I just sleep here and there, wherever I let me sleep, or I sleep outside. However I can sleep, I'll sleep. That was really tough.
Very sad part of her story is she lost custody of all five of her children because of her addiction.
Wow. I got three sons. I don't know who they are. I wish I can find them, you know, at least meet them. I was so messed up. I don't know what age they are. I don't know when they was born. That's a hard pill to swallow, you know what I'm saying? I love crack more than I did my kids.
She wasn't a trafficker. She wasn't a serious dealer. One of her felony convictions was for possessing what she described as $25 worth of crack, and she got a four-year prison sentence for that. She spent about a year of that behind bars, but that was the default in those days, which was a stiff prison sentence, very little treatment.
Obviously, the criminal justice system treats drug abusers differently now. What does she think about that?
She thinks a lot about that.
I'm sorry they dying. I'm sorry about that. You know what I'm saying? Come on now. They call it a disease now. But it's always been a disease. What's the difference between now and then?
She says, hey, where was the compassion 20, 30 years ago when her community was going through this horrible, traumatic ordeal?
So that was back in the 80s. But you guys also talk to someone who got caught up in the opioid epidemic today. Tell me about Richie Lipinski.
Richie is another Jersey Shore person. He grew up in Manasquan on the Jersey Shore, was really a top athlete, outstanding all-state football player.
I was getting recruited by Princeton, UPenn, Bucknell, Colgate.
And in many ways, he sort of fits the broad mold of the opioid crisis, a white teen, you know, from the suburbs, good family, and has a terrible sports injury. But it wasn't until much later, when he got deeply into dealing drugs, that he developed a full-blown opioid addiction.
We didn't know you could get physically addicted. This is 2004. And then one day I'm like, I'm not gonna get them. And then the withdrawal. And I'm like, oh my God. And that was the beginning of a 10-year hell.
And so what happened to him?
So in contrast to the crack years where there were no second chances, you know, the good news, you know, for Richie was that not only were there second chances, but there were second, third, fourth chances.
When the opioid epidemic came, now the pills are all in the suburbs. So now you have good families that kids are doing heroin and dying and pills. So then they start to pay attention.
Early on in Richie's story, he did have an opportunity to go through drug court. which is, it's not easy.
Yeah.
It's a pretty rigorous program, and you've got to hold up your end of the bargain. And he couldn't, you know, at that stage of his life, he just wasn't committed to turning his life around, and he really wasn't willing to commit to treatment. So ultimately, it took Richie to really bottom out before he took treatment seriously. And, you know, luckily for him, it really saved his life. And by his own admission, he kind of blew through all those and wasted all those opportunities.
When we come back,
the lowest level, neighborhood level traffickers are getting sentences that Congress still intended for the international gangsters. It's a tragedy.
This is The Why.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Annette John Hall. I'm talking to Asbury Park Press reporters Austin Bogues and Shannon Mullen about racial disparities in the way the criminal justice system deals with drug users and whether the nation's attitudes about drug abuses have changed. So, Michelle was black and Richie was white, but Richie committed crimes 30 years later. Can we really chalk up the differences in their cases to race?
Crack produced these crazy racial disparities, and really within a few years of these drugs, really harsh anti-crack laws getting put in place, it was really obvious that the results, whether they were intended or not, were producing super disparate numbers, and that blacks were being arrested, sentenced far out of proportion to whites. You know, at the federal level is probably where you can see it most profoundly. In the early 90s, the federal surveys show that in the beginning and still to this day, that most crack users are white, numerically speaking. And yet in a number of federal courts, including major cities, you know, Houston, Indianapolis, they were producing no white crack convictions in federal court. I mean, zero.
Wow.
Austin here. We talked with, you know, the guy who was a special DEA agent in charge in New York City. And you know, one of the quotes that stuck with us, you know, he said he's a white guy. He's very conservative. And he said, you know, this was one of the most racist things we ever did.
Hmm.
The face of crack was really kind of black. And from there, you got this fear of, you know, crack just kind of taking over, you know, inner cities and just leading to this widespread carnage.
Why do you think that the response to crack was so harsh?
There's definitely violence associated with the crack epidemic, right? You know, everybody will say that, look, there was these open air drug markets where, you know, a lot of times bullets started flying. You know, it was definitely centered in a lot of urban areas. It's just a big national conversation, basically. And you can find it all the way back to the 80s with, you know, kind of George H.W. Bush's first run for president.
It's as innocent looking as candy. But it's turning our cities into battle zones, and it's murdering our children. Let there be no mistake, this stuff is poison.
We talked to Eric Sterling, who was a young legal counsel for the House Subcommittee on Crime back in the late 80s, and one of his jobs was that summer when crack really hit the national news was to come up with a crime package for the Democrat side. So he was really one of the authors of what became a very harsh, you know, anti-crack federal law. And to this day, it's one of the greatest regrets of his life.
Really?
Yeah, Eric Sterling told us that he was really proud when President Reagan signed the Anti-Abuse Act of 1986. This is not a common thing to have a piece of legislation that you helped craft an important issue become national law. So he felt a certain amount of pride, but within a few years he realized, now this isn't really what we meant to do. So he resigned. his position.
Wow.
And became an advocate for criminal justice reform, ultimately legalization of drugs, and is in still does that work today.
The lowest level, neighborhood level traffickers are getting sentences that Congress still intended for the international gangsters that run the drug trade in Mexico and Colombia and elsewhere. It's a tragedy.
So we talked about these kinds of laws on the federal level. What about the state? Did the state implement these kinds of laws too?
Really, the guiding principle there is no party wanted to look soft on crime. And so they kind of outdid each other in coming up with proposals to really throw the hammer down on drug offenders in their states. Incredibly, Delaware even talked about the idea of bringing back the whipping post to deter drug crime. But many states, New Jersey being among them, passed very strict laws and really piled on the penalties.
So could it be, Austin, that the criminal justice system has simply learned more about how to deal with drug use and drug offenses, that it really is a public health crisis and it shouldn't be criminalized?
On the policy side, the medical side, and really, you know, the rank and file officers, they realized that after a certain point in time that this approach wasn't working. But it was getting the political willpower to kind of act in that direction. It takes a while to right that ship.
There's a number of police departments where you can walk in on designated days and say, hey, I have an addiction problem. I need help. And they will hook you up with treatment resources. Pennsylvania passed a law last year that automatically seals criminal records of, you know, the low-level offenders after 10 years of good behavior.
There's a big bipartisan push now today for criminal justice reform. It's kind of the hot buzzword. Looking forward as we look with an eye towards the 2020 campaigns. But a lot of times what we find is the rhetoric moves ahead of how quickly the policy can catch up with it. So President Trump signed into law the First Step Act, which helped to make retroactive some of the provisions that the Obama administration passed. One of the things that we found is, you know, the skeleton and the last vestiges of the crack epidemic, the system that was set up, in terms of this tough lock-em-up approach, it's still, a lot of it is still in place.
This impulse that we have to punish is just very strong. And I wonder, as the opioid epidemic, you know, drags on, you remember crack really kind of burned itself out within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
We're going into our third decade with opioids, and the loss of life is still so high. And, you know, I wonder if there would be some impatience that, hey, we tried the whole compassionate thing. It really didn't work. So let's revert back, you know, to kind of what we know best. So it's really going to be interesting how this issue plays out.
Well, Shannon, Austin, thank you so much for coming down today. And thank you for this very, very important piece of reporting.
Thanks for having us on.
We appreciate your interest in that.
Shannon Mullen and Austin Bogues are reporters for the Asbury Park Press. They reported their story along with their colleague, Andrew Galsworth. The Y is produced by me, Annette John Hall, along with Shai Binyakov, Alex Stern, and Kelsey Hansen, under the editorial direction of Katie Culinary. We had editing help for this episode from Kevin McCrory. Tweet me at AnnetteJH. Thanks for listening. We'll be back Monday.